This is an ABC podcast.
Gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Can't go on this way. Things gotta change around here. Say it loud, say it clear. Things gonna change around here.
Wow. Isn't that a fairly blunt, explicit 12-bar expression of frustration from Scott Stevens? DJ Aristotle's just really gone for it today. That, of course, is changed by Mavis Staples and Ben Harper opening up this edition of The Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life and occasionally interrogate Scott's song choices. That one's an intriguing one for today, I think, Scott.
It is.
Oh, sorry, Waleed Ali's my name. Scott Stevens is his, I should have said. Yes, go on. What was you thinking here?
I'm trying to set the tone a little bit. I mean, apart from anything else, I do have this thing for singers who have reached their prime late in life, who are producing the best work of their careers, just at the moment when others might expect for it to wind up. So I think of Leonard Cohen's last three albums, Mavis Staples, her recent collaboration with Ben Harper is the stuff that dreams are made of. And that little anthem that she begins the album with, We Get By, I thought really sets a nice little tone for what we're discussing. Because in many respects, the topic we're doing today feels like the continuation of something that we've been doing on and off, on and off, on and off for the better part of 18 months. Where there's an issue that we keep coming back to, and yet I feel that today we may well finally, perhaps not quite be getting to the bottom of it, but we may well get a sense of the full dimensions. And once that sense is gotten, well, let's just hope that a good deal of moral change may well be the result. What we're talking about, of course, Waleed, is in some respects the effect that the introduction of certain forms of radical, innovative technology have had on our capacity to live democratically, and I would even say morally. I mean, just think back over the last 18 months. We've kept dipping into this, the way that certain forms of social media, certain forms of ubiquitous technology have disrupted our capacity to deliberate together in a manner that is mutually vulnerable and has the chance of being mutually persuasive, that we swap that out for a kind of orgy of self-performance and mutual intimidation. We think about the ways that political communication has been hollowed out and flattened out, inundated with various forms of trivia or what Aldous Huxley called the purely inconsequential. Or you think about the way, for instance, that the sheer scale, the sheer size, the speed with which things are being produced and disseminated, information is being produced and disseminated in the world, the way that that's also had an effect, I think, not just in the most egregious cases of fomenting political or social violence or spreading things like false news, but also the way in which that itself, I think, has had a really corrosive effect on the nature of political communication and political discussion. So these are the things I think that we've been talking about constantly, but I think where we're going today is, what if this isn't actually just a new story at all? What if this is simply the final, let's pray it's not the terminal installment, in this long, long confrontation between democratic culture and political or capitalistic profit-seeking? In other words, what if this is just the last stage of something that Aristotle, believe it or not, I'm in a very Aristotle mood today. I'll warn you.
Just for something different. This is intriguing that you've finally reached for the Aristotle button.
I will warn you in advance, but you know, Aristotle, he of course didn't call it capitalism, but he recognized that something that was meant to be a source of benefit within the life of the city, namely the market where people meet one another face to face, they engage in a form of technology, namely the form of the coin, as a way of celebrating the process of mutual enhancement and gift giving. He said that the market is like a disease that is introduced into the life of the city because it incubates two vices. One he called epithumia, which means something like greed or lust, and the other that he called pleonexia, which means endless acquisitiveness. He says that these two things that are incubated by the the market that's meant to be of benefit to the city. These, in fact, have a corrosive effect. They're like a cancer that's been introduced into the life of the city. This is a very, very old story that then gets updated by people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who saw the introduction of economic exchange into political life as something that can breed certain forms of narcissism and the disregard of others. Marx, of course, saw precisely this. Even someone like Karl Polanyi at the beginning of the 20th century saw that something that capitalism does is it takes things of value, removes them from social life, and has the effect of destroying the very things of value that it's meant to protect or to trade in. So I think we have this long story where the market or capital or capitalism or in more recent times, industrial capitalism has this corrosive effect on our common life. And it may well be that what we're seeing now in these big monopolized conglomerates, these huge companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple and Microsoft, this is just the final installment of something that capitalism's been doing for a very, very long time.
Well, commodification.
The seeking out of endless new frontiers from which to extract profit. And what they've done...
Yeah, that's what commodification is, isn't it?
Yes.
I think that word does a lot of work, and not unnaturally so. I don't think you're stretching the meaning of the word to use it that way, but it hollows out the substance of a thing in order to make it something from which profit can be derived. That is, it turns it into a commodity. The latest phase of capitalism is interesting because it's turning something into a commodity, which is so pervasive in our lives, that is ourselves and our every movement and our every thought, by commodifying these things. If it is true that what we commodify, we necessarily hollow out, then we're jumping into some kind of necessarily existential crisis, aren't we? If we're hollowing out our very existences to be commodified.
Yeah.
That strikes me as a completely new frontier. It might be an extension of the logic of what we've seen before through the evolution of the marketplace and then, you know, into late capitalism. But there's a conceptual difference there, isn't there, that is incredibly consequential.
Except there's not. Because, I mean, just remember Marx's great diagnosis of what he called commodity fetishism, where capitalism doesn't just create commodities. It also gives them to you as a supernatural object that by you grabbing it, by you consuming it, adds infinitely more value to your life than you had before. If we take your analogy that this is the commodification of the self, the commodification of human behavior.
The commodification of human existence.
The commodification of human existence. Yes, that probably works.
I like how you changed your mind space of 3 seconds.
But what is then being handed back to us? And I think what's interesting is that the version of our existence that's being handed back to us by this creation or the reduction of human experience into endless slivers of human life that can then be shared with others, what's handed back to us has the status of something like a commodity fetish. In other words, it feels like our lives are being made far more interesting in the very act of hollowing them out. I keep thinking back.
No. I don't. Do I want to go along with that?
I think you should. I'll argue with you.
I know you think I should, but no. I think they're being made more convenient. I think the big commodity that is on offer, aside from ourselves, the big gain that is on offer through the process of commodifying ourselves is convenience. When I think of everything. Yeah. That is at the heart of all the changes that we take on at the expense of, for example, our privacy or even stable commercial and industrial arrangements in places like restaurants or whatever, through the gig economy as an example, the thing that is being offered to us in exchange is convenience. Even to the extent that when you have all this panic every now and again about your phone is listening to you and all this sort of stuff, and they send ads to you on a topic you were just having a conversation with someone about, all that, you know, that kind of discourse, even then, what is the ultimate response to that from most people?
A momentary dip?
No. In my experience, most people respond to that with, oh, so you mean I get ads that I'm interested in?
Okay.
Great. Right. In other words, the extension of this idea of convenience, of a tailored existence that is there to make it, you able to live your life without effectively moving anywhere or doing anything, that is almost the high watermark of things that we can achieve now. And I do think that's a conceptual difference. I don't know that that's a mere I get chronologically how it's an extension, but I do think we should receive this as something that is conceptually different to any previous forms of capitalism.
Look, that I think you're right. I mean, we've had conversations on the show in the past about convenience, and I think you're absolutely right to identify that as a kind of modern cult. However, let me just take one step back to not Marx or Aristotle this time, but to Soren Kierkegaard. He had this wonderful diagnosis of one of the effects of the mass media or the popular press, as he described it. He said, the result of gathering all of these things, some of them consequential, some of them inconsequential, into the pages of this newspaper, and then to use that newspaper as a tool that is meant to facilitate my ability to converse wittily and intelligently with other people at the, I don't know, coffee shop or salon or whatever. He says the effect of that is to give the impression that all things in the world happen for the express purpose that I may then gossip about them. Now, in some respects, that's a little bit harsh, but hasn't that now been realized in our time? What happens in the world happens so it may then be shared. What happened to me happened so that it may be captured in a video and posted. So I think there is something here. In the very moment that our lives are being hollowed out or commodified, at that very same moment, something is being given back to us, I think as a form of illusion, but it nonetheless gives us the sense that our lives are so much richer now that they're being shared, so much richer now that they're being captured by Instagram or posted on
Facebook. Does anyone believe that?
Yes.
Really?
Well,
I don't mean the marketing executives at tech companies believe it.
I don't care
because I feel like we're in the middle.
I don't care if people actually believe. As Marx put it, you show me the way you live, and I'll show you what you really believe. I think that's probably more the idea. I'm not sure if people actually think that their lives are enriched, but they certainly act like they are.
I think that's too flat. Because what that, and this is a highly specific example now, but I think what that overlooks is the kind of neurological slavery that our devices conscript us into. So I think we act in ways that are not in accordance with how we believe, because we are, in some sense, I don't want to stretch this too far, but helpless before the ways in which we're being manipulated.
Yes.
So that I think that puts a dampener on what Marx is saying. And I think we are in an age now where people are beginning to have a perhaps mild sober panic, if such a thing can be said to exist, about the impact of technology in our lives, about particularly screen time seems to be the focus on it now. I think we are far less concerned than we should be, though, about this phenomenon of perpetual corporate surveillance. Whereby our whole lives is surveilled and then commodified, and what long-range, perhaps unforeseeable consequences that can have. Because what we're really doing at that point is we're taking the essence of human life as we've lived it and understood it for millennia and tinkering with it, being prepared to play with it, and without a clear idea of what it is that the benefit is beyond, as I said before, convenience, which is why I think we keep coming back to that, I keep coming back to that concept.
I'm with you there. I'm with you completely.
Okay, excellent. Nice. Should we go to a guest?
Yes, please. Yes.
We've run out of things to say. This is The Mindfield. You can listen to the show on RN. You may be doing that right now, in which case, thank you very much for doing so. But we also have a podcast that has additional discussion and things like that. We find that 25 minutes is simply insufficient for the giant brains that we have on this show. So we tend to try to get more out of our guests. And they're often very good and they hang around at no extra cost. You can listen to the podcast, by the way, anytime on the ABC Listen app. You can also subscribe to The Mindfield on whatever platform it is that you do such things. Scott.
Our guest today isn't just a giant brain. I would describe her as a cultural force of nature. Shoshana Zuboff is the Charles Edward Wilson Professor Emerita at Harvard Business School and the author of what I think is the book that will forever define 2019. It's a book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power, just to, raise the stakes through the roof. Shoshana, thank you so much for joining us on The Mindfield.
Oh, thank you, Scott. It's an honor.
So let's maybe not settle the issue, but let's try to get some clarity about what's new and what's not. It seems to me that advertising has always aimed at changing the behavior of buyers, not just appealing to it. And there's always, like I said, been this kind of tension between capitalism and democratic life. To what extent are we living through a radically new cultural moment?
Well, you know, this is an old story, Scott. Plus ça change, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So, of course, it's always possible to see the world through the lens of continuity. But when we do that, we tend to miss what is unprecedented. History is marked by discontinuities, and it's our failure to pay attention and be mobilized and aware of these discontinuities that end up driving us in directions that we did not choose to go. And this is one of those times in history where these roads cross. So think of this one simple fact. In the year 1987, which I don't know how old you guys are, but for me, 1987 feels like yesterday. 1987, 1% of the world's information was digital. Fast forward to 2013, and 98% of the world's information is digital. So we're talking about a very short span of time in which a complete upheaval, a complete sea change, literally a revolution in the nature of information, digital. So let's say when we talk about capitalism, yes, there are deep continuities in processes that drive capitalism. You've been talking about one of the principal ones, which is commodification. So yeah, there are continuities there. But then when we say, well, what precisely is being commodified and how? Once we ask those questions, we have tumbled down Alice's rabbit hole, and we're into a parallel universe, something that has never existed before. What is being commodified now in our time is not the forests, it's not the rivers, it's not the meadows, it's private human experience. How is that possible? How is that even conceivable? The only way that it's conceivable is that now, for the first time ever, private human experience can be digitized. It can be translated into behavioral data, and it can be computed. And through the results of such computation, new kinds of markets have come into being, and this changes everything.
So, Shoshana, I've sketched my concerns with that. What are yours?
I've sketched my concerns too.
It only took about 800 pages, didn't it?
Well, yes. Is that a sketch? I'm not sure.
That's not a question you want to ask me. We've got a few minutes with our listeners. Well, look, let me just call out some of the highlights of today's capitalism, which, as you've already mentioned the title of my book, I call it surveillance capitalism. Let me sketch out some of the key mechanisms and methods of surveillance capitalism, and then talk for a minute about why it's called surveillance capitalism. And I think maybe that will give us a platform for talking about what our concerns are and what our concerns should be. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Go for it.
Good. Okay. So we begin with commodification. Like earlier eras of capitalism, yes, surveillance capitalism mirrors those mechanisms of growth and evolution, commodification. What that means is that capitalism takes things that live outside the market dynamic and it figures out ways to drag them into the marketplace to make them into things that can be sold and purchased. So as we've just said, in our time, a lot of that stuff is used up. Nature is used up. A lot of things are used up. There's a new horizon. People, business people, are looking for new sources of revenue, most importantly, new sources of margins, value added. And what that means is we've got to find new things to commodify. The new territory, the new frontier is private human experience. Unilaterally claimed as raw material for translation into behavioral data. Some of those behavioral data, yes, they are used to improve the products and services that we use. Sometimes we use those things for free, sometimes we purchase them. But what was discovered early in the 21st century, 2000 to 2002, what was discovered, and this discovery was made at Google, was that there are parallel streams of behavioral data that are coming off of our experience. Back then, these things were called data exhaust, digital breadcrumbs, all of these giving the idea that they had no value, they're waste material. But what was discovered was that these parallel streams of data were full of rich predictive signals. I call these streams of data behavioral surplus because these data were more than what was needed for service improvement. So now these streams of behavioral surplus are being channeled into pipelines. Think of them as supply chains, which ultimately have become more complex supply chain networks. These supply chains take behavioral surplus with their rich predictive signals into a new kind of factory, a new kind of manufacturing process that we call machine intelligence or artificial intelligence, where these data are computed. What happens inside these factories? Well, a minute ago, a year ago, Facebook had a document. It was written in 2017 and it was leaked to the press. And what this document showed was what goes on in Facebook's manufacturing process, what it calls its AI hub. And in that manufacturing process, what's going on, among other things, is literally, quote unquote, trillions of data points, behavioral data points, are being ingested every day. Trillions of data points about human experience being ingested by these computers every day. And in that process, 6 million predictions of human behavior, and Facebook used that phrase in quotes, predictions of human behavior are being produced every second. So what's happening now is behavioral surplus shunted through this supply chain pipelines into these new manufacturing processes, computation, and out of this computation analysis, chomp, 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 new kinds of products are being produced.
All right. These so are you've definitely, yeah, you've flagged those products, which is going to be rich pickings for us, I think, in the podcast, which is going to begin very soon. The radio portion now at an end. Is there anything, Scott, that you want to tease for the podcast? Is there something that's piqued your interest here.
Well, I mean, it just seems to me that for this new level of efficient capitalism to work, where the element of uncertainty is extracted from it or is taken out of the equation, something fundamental needs to take place then in the very nature of economic exchange, you know, the very idea of reciprocity and the very idea of risk. So it seems to me that this is necessarily kind of extension or perversion of what capitalism is meant to be.
So not just continuity, that's what I'm hearing. Anyway, we're about to head off to the podcast. Shoshana Zuboff is Charles Edward Wilson Professor Emerita at Harvard Business School, our guest for this week's Mindfield.
So Shoshana, can I just pick up then on this particular point? Because those who sing the praises of capitalism's merits say that there are two things that necessarily commend it over and against an overregulated or more, say, politically controlled system. One is capitalism thrives on uncertainty, therefore any attempt to predict in advance what's going to be profitable, what's not, who's going to make money, who's not, can have unintended and necessarily deleterious consequences. And so there's a degree of risk that needs to be fostered, of course, within certain limits. The other thing that's supposed to make capitalism work is that there's supposed to be a degree of symmetry in the relationship between the producer and the buyer, or between the person who is making the products and selling them and the person who is buying them. What you've just described, however, is a form of capitalism that is trying to locate all of the information on one side of the equation, which is more than the most controlled or regulated or system that a government could imagine, or an authoritarian government could imagine. And it's also eliminating risk. In other words, it's trying to make the process of advertising or pitching products to people with the maximum degree of certainty that you can imagine, so much so that you're almost guaranteed that they're going to buy your product. I'm just trying to understand how in the history of capitalism, these two departures from what's supposed to make capitalism capitalism have taken place.
All right. So what is the source of revenue and profit for the surveillance capitalists? We understand this began at Google, it moved to Facebook, it becomes the default economic logic in the tech sector, and now it moves through the normal economy in every sector. So the key thing here is we're in the business of predicting human behavior. And we talk about these six million predictions being produced every second. Where are these going? These new products, these prediction products, are now coming out of the factory and they're being sold to business customers in a new kind of marketplace. This is a marketplace that trades exclusively in human futures, the way we trade in pork belly futures or oil futures, for example. Now we have markets that trade in human futures. What is the purpose of these markets? What does it mean to sell predictions of human behavior? It means that we're selling certainty. So here's where we get into the discontinuities, and your conversation is right on track, because even though we start with commodification and it looks like, oh, capitalism, plus ça change, but in fact, as we move through this, we come out in a very different kind of world. We're selling certainty. We're selling guaranteed outcomes to business customers. The only way that we can do this is to amass gargantuan concentrations of information about individuals, groups, and populations. Because in order to compete in the competition to sell certainty, those competitive dynamics require a few things. They require huge volumes of data, economies of scale, varieties of data, economies of scope. But ultimately, they've discovered that the most predictive data come from actually intervening in the state of play, actually intervening in human behavior, and learning how to use the digital architecture to remotely and always subliminally influence behavior, tune it, herd it in the directions that serve the business interests of business customers playing in these marketplaces, and ultimately that serve the bottom line of surveillance capital. So now we are far beyond the kind of capitalism described by Hayek or Friedman, and of course, even the kind of capitalism described by Adam Smith. Because what Smith and Hayek, Friedrich Hayek after him, believed was that capitalism requires freedom. It requires freedom because markets are inherently unknowable. Markets are the agglomeration of millions and millions of transactions that cannot be seen, that cannot be predicted. And the only way to create anything profitable, anything constructive out of all of that mystery, is to give each actor the maximum degrees of freedom. And if each actor acts somewhat rationally with respect to their own self-interest, then you can begin to see a logic coming out of the totality that could never be predicted and that could never be sort of analyzed or understood by any single body, not by a government, not by a human being, not by any form of analysis. So freedom is the key.
Is the chief concern that you have one then of gross human manipulation, or is it one of the disruption of markets themselves because they are no longer unknowable, and so it becomes a fundamentally different thing? Like, where would you locate, for somebody listening to this going, well, actually, as I hear about the increasing predictability of human behavior, I think that that's potentially all to the good because it might allow us to plan for and eliminate problems, for example, or whatever. What would you say to someone who listens with that kind of ear as to the truly catastrophic potentials of this?
All right. Well, this goes back to something we said a little bit ago, which is what puts the surveillance in surveillance capitalism. So let's talk about this for just a moment. There is no way to translate, to take our behavior, to treat it as raw material, to translate it into products and sell it to business customers. These products are about us, but they are not for us. The information that is gathered is about us, but the analysis of that information does not accrue to our benefit. We're talking about business customers who are using this predictive capability not to solve our problems, not to improve our health, not to solve world hunger, not to solve the climate crisis, but rather to maximize the probability that when they try to sell us something, we will buy it. So that's the nature of competitive trading in human futures. And as I said a moment ago, one of the key sources of data now has become the way in which surveillance capitalism has gradually, over these years of experimentation, learned to intervene in human behavior in order to modify behavior in ways that actually come closer to approximating certainty in their predictions. So we saw this in Facebook's contagion experiments. We saw this in Google's incubation of the augmented reality game Pokemon Go. These are varieties of experimentation where the idea is, number one, we can successfully change, tune, herd, modify human behavior remotely using subliminal cues that are in the case of the Facebook contagion experiments, planted in the online milieu and Facebook pages. And in the case of Pokemon Go, using the dynamics of gamification and social comparison to actually move people, their real bodies, through real cities and real streets into certain businesses and establishments that then pay the game for footfall, for the business that these people bring to that pizza parlor or that McDonald's or that Starbucks. So this is how the original terms of online advertising, click-through rates were the original prediction product. Online advertisers bought those products and they got people clicking on their websites. Now what happens is we know how to herd actual people through the city and get them to go to the actual establishment. So footfall replaces click-through rates. Now, none of this works unless it's hidden, because throughout the last 20 years, every single survey, every piece of research, when you expose people to the backstage operations that are occurring here, what they're taking, the vast amount of information about each one of us that's actually ending up in their servers and in their computational analysis for prediction, that, and as this moves into the real world, that they take our faces, that they take our posture, that they take our conversations, they take our voices, they take the cadence of our voices, all of these things that now come through, quote, smart products, personalized services, digital assistants. These are all supply chain interfaces for these vast flows of rich predictive behavioral surplus.
Sorry, so, Shoshana, I just have a quick question, though, because we're just rapidly running out of time for this portion. About complicity. I mean, there is an extent to it. I just note, for instance, that the drop-off in Facebook users following the revelations of the full extent of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, for instance, that didn't even last 6 months. The first part of this year, Facebook posted one of its largest uptakes, quarterly uptakes, in new users onto the site. There is an extent to which, if what you're describing is right, and I've got no reason to think that it isn't, there is a very real extent to which users are complicit in their own enslavement. But there's something even related to that, and here, if I can just be completely gratuitous, you know, Waleed and I both work for media organizations. Both of our organizations publish stories about some of the damage that using, say, Instagram or Facebook, or the extent to which we're exposed in the way that we use Google search engine. We publish stories about this, and yet we all still hawk our wares on Facebook. I mean, one of the things about this hollowing out, yes, there's a hollowing out of human experience, but there's also a mercenary approach to all of the information that is then posted onto it to try to get people onto its pages or to keep people on its site. Media organizations are fully complicit, it seems to me, in the very problem that you're diagnosing. I'm wondering about what it might take, to go back to Mavis Staples' song, what might it take individually, but also from institutions of good faith, if I can put it that way, institutions who care about the health of a democratic culture. What might it take to change this particular situation?
Okay, well, a lot of questions there. So the key thing here, I think, that, you know, we want our listeners to understand is that these processes that we've been talking about are on a collision course with democracy. And when we talk about using this vast digital architecture that exists now to modify human behavior at scale for the purposes of profit, we're talking about intervening in those very subtle but critical human experiences that we refer to with words like autonomy, self-regulation, human agency, self-determination, individual sovereignty. Because we're now living in a world where backstage operations are using subliminal cues to shift human behavior in a variety of directions that serve this massive commercial undertaking. Without these capacities for human agency, autonomy, self-determination, democratic functioning is simply unimaginable. From the level of superstructure, looking at the totality of this, we're talking about entering the third decade of the 21st century with a society not marked by the democratization of knowledge that we anticipated, but instead marked by the most extreme asymmetries of knowledge and the power to know and influence and control human behavior that comes with that knowledge, the most extreme asymmetries that we have seen since the pre-modern era. We're actually thrown back to a kind of pre-Gutenberg era when knowledge was for the elite and the masses had no access to learning, to knowledge. This is the world that we're creating now. Now you ask, how is it possible for this world to stand? How are we complicit in this world over and over again in the trivia of our actions every single day? Well, I write about 16 reasons that answer the question, how does this stand? But let's just talk about three of them from the user's point of view, our point of view, the individual's point of view. First of all, these systems have been designed, immense amounts of capital have gone into engineering these systems to keep us in ignorance. And that's why people can say, oh, hey, I love those targeted ads. That's so convenient. Because the backstage operations and what really is at stake in the human story, that is hidden. And not only is it hidden technologically, but it's hidden because of the rhetoric that has saturated us over the last 20 years. It's been a rhetoric of democratization, a rhetoric of disintermediation, a rhetoric of convenience, misdirection, obfuscation, and mendacity have been the kind of propaganda we've been told that these things are inevitable. This is the way digital technology works. And in fact, that is probably the worst lie of all, because of course, it's easy to imagine digital technology without these mechanisms of surveillance capitalism, but of course, impossible to imagine surveillance capitalism without the digital. So one thing is, we have been engineered for ignorance. The second thing is that these things that we're talking about, these mechanisms and methods, are unprecedented. We have never before lived in a world where 98% of information is digitalized. These things are unprecedented. We can't imagine them. And therefore, when we encounter them, we chronically think that they are something else. We can only encounter the unprecedented by interpreting it through what's already familiar to us. By definition, the unprecedented is kind of invisible. And so we see this stuff happening and we keep thinking that it has something to do with advertising. By now, it has very little to do with advertising. It has to do with selling predictions of our futures to companies who want to pay for that so that they can maximize their profits by knowing what we will do next, period. That's in insurance, it's in real estate, it's in health, it's in education, it's in every sector. Finally, the third key thing that we have to know about the trap that users are in is the foreclosure of alternatives. I know about these mechanisms. You know about these mechanisms. People are becoming increasingly aware of these mechanisms. And yet, I need to get my kids' homework from the school's platform. I need to get my health results from my physician's health platform. I need to make plans with friends and family for dinner. I need to talk on my phone. Practically everything I do, including this afternoon searching on a government website for a tax form and seeing all the trackers that are being blocked in the corner of my screen. Virtually everything we have to do on a daily basis to live an effective life, forget about convenience, to just get through a day relatively effectively, forces us to march through surveillance capitalism supply chains, because every touch point with the internet right now is an interface with these supply chains. The internet is now owned and operated by surveillance capitalism. The alternatives have been foreclosed. The only thing that can change this now is democracy. The only thing that can change this now is law, and lawmakers and citizens like us who insist that this is not the trajectory to the future that we have bought into. This is a road that takes us to China. It takes us to the diminishment of democracy, and it takes us to the profound degradation of the Enlightenment values that are the foundation for all democratic societies. And so...
I thought you finished. Yeah, it's interesting because the response is law. We're dealing with a set of concepts that, as you say, speak to a different set of assumptions about the world. And so I wonder ultimately how effective law can be in doing that as long as it's operating or laboring under those kinds of assumptions about what exactly freedom means, what exactly the market means, all of those sorts of things. Alas, we are out of time. I'm glad that you've hung around to listen to this podcast on your device. Hope you feel bad about that right now. Shoshana, thank you very much for lending us your expertise today. I think we can say there's probably no one else who could quite have done it.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Best of luck to you both. Thank you so much.
Hi, folks. It's Scott again. Just when you thought the podcast was over, there's more. If you want to read a bit more from Shoshana Zuboff, of course, I would suggest that you buy her book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It really is something. But I also just wanted to draw your attention to the fact that she's written something for the ABC. It's called The Threat of Surveillance Capitalism and the Fight for a Human Future. If you wanted to revisit some of the things that she discussed today or that we were trying to talk around, that would be a great place to do it. So where do you go to read this? Just go to ABC Religion and Ethics. That's www.abc.net.au/religion.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.